Hello, Radioland. You're listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. This is another episode of Darshiv. And today, we are going to be talking a little bit about some of the work that we've been doing at the Yukon Archives during the quarantine period, during the pandemic, to kind of remain active and make sure that folks know that the Archives and Special Collections at the University of Connecticut are there for you, and show you some of the cool stuff we got. My guest today is Rebecca Parmer, who is the head of Archives and Special Collections at the University of Connecticut. Rebecca, thanks for coming to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we decided to do some work, of course, while we were at home, you know, being remote and whatnot. One of those things is an exhibition that we kind of put together, which is still kind of ongoing. We're going to get to that in a little bit, but first, Rebecca, I just want to ask, you know, is there anything going on at the archives right now that you maybe think folks should know a little bit more about?
Yeah, absolutely. So students are back on site for the spring semester, and we are so happy to see them back in the archives, you know, for classes and for projects. We're also working on a couple of collaborative projects that we're really excited about. We're working on a project to digitize and provide access to some really cool sound recordings from a class that ran at UConn from around 1970 to like the mid-1990s. It's called Black Experience in the Arts, and it was a collaborative effort between faculty in the music department, the Center for Black Studies, to create a course that would expose students to the contributions of Black artists. So over this 20-25 year, you know, ish period, it brought artists and musicians, writers, journalists, sculptors, dancers to campus to talk directly to students, to engage in discussion, and to offer live performance and discussion of their work. So I think we have around 350 recordings from these classes, and we're working to digitize and put those online so that everybody has that opportunity to have this experience, to hear this incredible insight, you know, into the lives and experiences of these artists. So if you're, you know, interested in learning more, there's lots of information about this on our website.
And for those of you who have been listening to the show over the past couple of years, I have been playing some of this material. Jane Cortez comes to mind as one of many of the performers with the various art background in which they excel at. And we'll continue to be playing some of that material here on Darshiv. As a unit, we're all, I think, really excited and hands on deck to get this stuff out there. There's some pretty interesting and unexpected individuals who ended up coming to UConn since 1970 to kind of speak to this class. So glad you brought that up. Okay, so as far as what we've been doing, I guess more as our public-facing work, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about the digital project, 25 for 25. I have been mentioning it here on the show, but haven't really sampled anything from it. Can you tell us a little bit about where this idea came from and what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So 25 for 25 is a digital video-based exhibition that explores our collections and the activity of collecting, and then how that's changed over time. So the genesis of this project started in 2020, which marked the 25th anniversary of the dedication of what was then called the Thomas J. Dodd Research Center. It's now known as the Dodd Center for Human Rights. But this is the facility that houses Archives and Special Collections. And when it was built, it was specifically designed to facilitate the care and management, and most importantly, the use of these rare materials. So when the center was initially founded in 1995, it brought together the university's historical manuscripts and archives and special collections under the same roof for the first time. So not only were the collections now physically integrated, physically together, but the policies, the practices, the collecting activities, and the collecting directions were now together under the same roof for the first time. So that move led to an increased focus on the interdisciplinarity of collections, how they relate to one another, their intersections, their connections, and the different ways to approach collecting. And it also informed, you know, how we sort of approach the activity of collecting and the practice of collecting. So we wanted to commemorate that occasion by both celebrating our collections and their growth over the past 25 years, and then also to explore how they change over time. So how collections are not static, how they constantly grow and evolve, And then also to explore a little bit of the power that these collections have to inspire, to engage, and to inform.
And I don't want to give too much away in terms of, like, you know, how it is that I situated myself within this project, but maybe just to ask naively, what kind of direction, I guess, was given to the unit for maybe what we wanted people to see?
That's a great question. It was pretty broad. I think what we wanted to do, the primary direction was identify an object or sort of a group of objects that really explored change over time, that explored some aspect of the practice of collecting. So the sort of intention, the research, the connection between collections, how your personal practice as archivists has evolved or grown over time. You know, every archivist here has sort of inherited collections as well as developed new ones. And so we really wanted to explore that sense of where are archivists as professionals sort of in this process? How are they facilitating and sort of stewarding and shepherding the growth of these collections? But also, how are they talking to one another? You know, how are you working with your colleagues to build collections that lend important insight or new perspectives or can be looked at in different ways across different collecting directions or collecting areas?
And in terms of the, as you mentioned, sort of the individual's work as the information worker kind of overseeing these collections, what kind of challenges did you sort of see from kind of the management side of the project in terms of how individuals tackled, you know, making media, basically?
Yeah, I mean, a project like this was really interesting because there's a huge range of sort of facility with technology, comfort levels with technology. We were doing this project right in the middle of the pandemic, in the middle of quarantine, when most of us were at home, you know, for 4 or 5 days a week. So, you know, access to technology, access to the collections was extremely limited. So from a management side, it was a really interesting exercise in having to do a lot of pre-planning, a lot of storyboarding, making sure that everybody had some access to resources that they needed, whether that was cell phones or iPads, digital cameras, and then also connecting with other colleagues, you know, that we had in the library that we knew had expertise in video editing, sound editing, that sort of thing. So no staff member was sort of responsible for every aspect of putting this video together. We really did rely on our colleagues in communications and our colleagues at other regional campus libraries who had that kind of expertise and really were instrumental in helping us pull the videos together.
So those of you would-be archivist social media influencers out there, you've just heard it here that having a little bit of know-how in the video making digital media department is an asset for the work that we do to
Definitely.
Make sure that what we do is shared broadly and in different formats. Cool. Okay, well, how about we take a listen to one of the first clips of three, I think, that we're going to do, and I'll have you unpack it after we check it out.
Advertisements for Billy Hahn's video recordings were published in fanzines, as seen here in issue number 1 of Final Attempt, stating that 3 volumes were available for trade or purchase, each consisting of 4-hour recordings on super high-quality VHS video cassettes. The punk and hardcore subculture really harnessed what was the height of do-it-yourself ethic through the use of analog consumer media, made for low-barrier publishing in print, audio, and video recordings. Demo tapes, bootlegs, screen printing, Xerox show flyers, fanzines, community radio, and indie record labels were tools harnessed to spread the positive mental attitude of young kids finding community. In addition, the politics of the subculture were largely anti-racist, anti-corporate, anti-drug, and non-hierarchical, as can be seen in this video, where lead singers are replaced by fans in the audience, and performances ending with more fans on stage than off it.
Okay, what can you tell us about that?
So that should be a familiar voice. This is you, Graham Stinnett, and this video is discussing an amateur video by videographer Billy Hahn of a hardcore punk rock performance at the historic Anthrax venue in Norwalk, Connecticut. So what I think is really interesting about this this video and this clip in particular is that you're talking here about these recordings and how they were advertised for purchase. And what I think is really interesting here is this discussion of format. So the recordings and how they're created and the importance of that format to this community of punk rock musicians and concertgoers and listeners. And this is a very intentional act by the punk rock community, this sort of creation of low barrier forms, you know, of creation and distribution as a sort of intentional way of connecting with one another and of building community. And it's so important, I think, that we try to collect materials that reflect that intentionality and which bring that sort of insight and understanding to this world. So I think that this idea of sort of the wide range of formats, you know, range and variety of formats that archives have and that we deliberately collect can be surprising to folks who might expect that most of what we deal with is, you know, books and manuscripts and photographs and paper and that sort of thing. And while, you know, we know that VHS and cassettes and beta tapes come with challenges in terms of how we preserve and provide access to that content that's on them, it's a really important artifactual evidence of this community and its activities. And so that's why it's so important that we continue to sort of collect them and sort of make them accessible through projects like this and through digitization efforts and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a good point that you mentioned as far as, you know, what gets made into this video is like a copy of a copy, right? Like the original copy is not in our collection. It is actually a distributed VHS that was sold.
Right.
That then I had to make a mad dash to digitize before we, it literally came back like a week maybe before we had to exit the building due to the pandemic. So just the fact that the material that we're even working with to produce a video on YouTube for the average interested party to see is like this, you know, removed process
yeah.
in which we're making things accessible. So yeah, I think that hidden labor that goes into all of the preservation that, you know, archivists are like pretty entrenched in is half of what we ended up getting to show, I think, in trying to make little digital videos out of these things.
Yeah, absolutely. That idea of the hidden labor of putting together not just an exhibition like this, but making the types of collections that we collect accessible and usable, all that labor is behind the scenes. You know, you're never going to see it. All you see is the video on YouTube or, you know, the digitized item in our digital repository. And so I think it's a really important aspect of a project like this to surface some of that, you know, the real thoughtfulness and the sort of the work that has to happen to make, you know, to make these resources accessible.
And that seems to be also what I find students tend to get excited about, even though maybe they don't necessarily wrap their heads around like the process in which the technology operated, but showing students the analog version of where this stuff all kind of came from, you know, through everything from zines to records to t-shirt making, you know, that kind of stuff. Like the equipment in which it took to make those things are usually the thing we have to have in mm-hmm. order to get back to the original.
Totally.
So that redundancy of old tech is like part of the game too. Okay, cool. In terms of the topic of the 1980s punk stuff, you know, we've covered that pretty well here on the show. I will probably be rebroadcasting in some capacity more of that tape, but if you want to listen to it or check it out, just please contact us at the Archives and Special Collections. I'm trying to track down anybody who was actually in any of those shots, so if this sounds familiar to you and you're hearing this, please reach out. Okay, let's check out clip number two.
Let us look at the details of one photograph. Although we do not know the specifics of the work these women are doing, it is evident that it is dirty and labor-intensive. The women have dirty dresses and faces. Over their dresses, they have only aprons to protect them from the grime. There is no visible safety measures that we take for granted. Gloves, safety goggles, protective clothing. Even with what we know about what was going on in Connecticut industry and ethnic history in the 1800s, When I look at these photographs, I have more questions than answers. I want to know, what was life like for these working women? What circumstances brought them to these factories? What were their lives like outside of the factories? We do not know these women's names or their individual circumstances, but just viewing these photographs tells us so much about the conditions of women of the working class at that time. And they give us a lot of fodder for other areas of research in women's, ethnic, labor, and business history.
Okay, that was an even better segue than I hoped. Basically, the nameless individuals that are on the record from the past. Curious. What can you tell us about that clip and why did you pick it?
Yeah, so this is Laura Smith. She's our archivist for business, labor, and railroad collections. And she's examining here a photograph from one of our business collections. I think it's the Ansonia Brass Company records. So it's a photograph of women machine operators at the brass company, and we have a date on it. It's 1899. And she starts to go through what you can see in the photograph. It's mostly young women. The conditions are fairly grimy. And then she starts to go into what you can't see, the names of these women, their backgrounds, where they came from, where they lived, their specific roles at the company, what they were paid, that sort of thing. And what I think Laura does really, really well here in this exploration is to talk a little bit about some of the different ways that we can look at archives, what they can tell us on the surface, but also their limitations, the additional context that's critical to help us, you know, truly understand what's going on. So not just in the photograph, but in the company, how that company relates to larger societal issues, that sort of thing. So, you know, this photograph offers us a window into a particular time and event, but it also, as she says, it inspires more questions than answers. And I think that's the real power of archives. So when you engage with archival collections and you really start to dig in and, you know, piece together these disparate elements, it can lead to new discoveries and new questions and new ways of seeing our past.
Yeah, I think that's a sort of very strong suit for Laura, specifically Laura Smith's sort of work as an archivist, but also, you know, doing a lot of history work with the organizations that she tries to document. And I feel like her collecting area is also possibly one of the more voluminous and, you know, maybe there's a little bit more grime involved in the sort of grabbing of the records themselves, you know, working with everything from like company ledgers to these massive amounts of card cataloging of the small, minute details that these companies sometimes kept about those employees and the processes of the job. So I guess as far as that is concerned, what maybe isn't really getting picked up in our attempt to show these materials in a video format that removes it from the physical? You know, what, it's the stuff without the stuff. What can you tell us about, like, what maybe we're not getting in addition to, you know, here's the questions that a research prospector would come to the collection with?
Right, right. I think you've hit right on it. It's that idea of context. So much of sort of the ability to look at archives and understand archival materials is about seeing them in their context. And what I mean by context here is seeing an object in relation to other objects around it that help us understand what it is we're looking at. The context of how and when it was created, how it relates to other events or people or material, that sort of thing. So, you know, even just taking sort of an individual photograph or a sound recording or a letter, it's hard to take a single object or even a small group of objects and really be able to communicate that really important context in video format. So much of that is just about sort of the physicality of material. It's about the materialness of archives. And it's also about that context.
I know we've harped on this in the past, especially in this episode I did about the CTDA with Mike Kamesis, our digital repository, but sort of not seeing the back end, right? Like the number of boxes, you're only really getting the one or two. And in this case, you're getting the single item brought to you in the four. But hopefully it piques the questions that lead to stronger research questions and then sort of more engagement with a broader holistic perspective of that history itself. In terms of the technical aspects of how people went about making these videos, you know, did you find any major differences, I guess? I know that I personally can see some changes between like how one archivist versus another went about sort of narrating it, but anything jump out to you about those sort of formats?
Yeah, I mean, I think what was really cool about this exhibition is that every individual archivist put their own spin on it, either through their own interpretation or the way that they approached talking about, you know, these objects or this material. So some archivists, for example, like Kristen Eshelman, who is our archivist for multimedia collections in the Northeast Children's Literature Collection, she really took a couple of resources and was inspired to create from them. So there's a really great example on the YouTube channel of a book that she looks at four books about sewing, historic sewing patterns. And she uses those to inspire her own creativity, and she creates a pattern from those books. And so it's this ability for sort of archives to inspire creativity, inspire the act of creation. And that was the way that she approached this project. And I think it was a totally different perspective. It talks about a different element of how archives can be useful for many purposes or you know, many many different types of research and sort of inspiration and creativity. And then some, you know, some staff members were really focused on telling sort of the larger story. So trying to use the object as a sort of lens through which we can understand this wider collection or you know, this wider sort of societal event. Betsy Pittman, who's our university archivist and is also in charge of our political collections, she talks more holistically, for example, in her video about political collections and the important role that they serve in sort of creating transparency, the idea of accountability, that archives are here to hold institutions and governments and organizations accountable by documenting those practices, by documenting the decision making. And so she gives this really compelling, I think, video. And this is why it was so hard to choose just three clips. I wish I could talk about everybody's. But she does this really sort of thoughtful and comprehensive understanding about the role that these political collections play in government transparency and accountability, and especially from the citizen's perspective. I think the power of this exhibition is that it really sparked people to be creative and to put their own sort of personal perspective on it. You know, each staff member could pursue the line of inquiry that I think was most interesting to them. And I think that, you know, if you watch these in succession or even if you just dip in and out, you really get a sense of that.
Yeah, I agree. And one thing that I'm thinking through now is that there's a good chance that each of us that produced videos are probably speaking mostly to the research base that they're getting inquiries from, right? Like Laura's videos are very much a historical approach to inquiring to the collection, because that's probably who she's actually speaking to directly. Whereas Kristen's work, you know, she's trying to engage predominantly art students and creatives to do something different with what we've got. So I think it lends itself already to, you know, who we're trying to reach out to.
Yeah, and that huge variety of audiences that find archives and special collections useful and, you know, interesting and sort of interrogative in lots of different ways.
Right. Very good. Okay, let's move on to the last clip and we'll catch you on the other side of it.
These are print periodicals that combine visual art, literature, reportage, design, commentary, and other forms of expression in ways we didn't expect or that challenge us as viewers and readers. Like zines, these periodicals cannot be easily categorized. They stimulate and inspire new ways of seeing and connecting. I guess we can call them art magazines. Students coming to the archives get excited about periodicals that feature young visual artists from around the world. Photographers, graffiti artists, printmakers, muralists, animators, songwriters, and playwrights. In the archives, we try to collect graphic art that expands our collections and that come directly from artists themselves. These can be artist books, print portfolios, exhibition catalogs, box sets from small presses, and zine libraries. These materials can be used in a variety of ways, like student projects or exhibitions, or for instruction sessions.
What can you tell us about that one? What drew you to that?
All right, so this final clip is from Melissa Waterworth Batt. She's our archivist for rare books and natural history and literary collections. And here she's talking about materials that we sort of informally group under this term art magazines. So in part, Melissa's talking about, you know, types of material that we collect that students find interesting or exciting or relatable. And what I think is really interesting about art magazines, and in part why they get students so excited, is that these are collections that we're collecting contemporaneously. So we're collecting them as they are being produced, rather than something that's been published in the past that we're going back and collecting retroactively. And what I really appreciate about Melissa's discussion here is that she points to these resources as something that's being collected very intentionally. So how they reflect some of the ways in which we have been able to build breadth and depth and, you know, new perspectives into our collections, as well as building new connections between collections. So how they relate to one another, those interdisciplinary connections and points of entry and inquiry that help us provide a fuller picture or a better understanding of history and of lived experience. And I think that idea of intentionality, that very thoughtful and deliberate way that we think about and build our collections, especially contemporary collections, is maybe this something that's not as evident or well understood outside of this context. But that act of collecting is ideally very conscious. You know, it's a very conscious act. And so that's something that we acknowledge, you know, has both upsides and downsides to it, especially as we look at past practices and the voices and the perspectives that are missing from our collection. But this is an attempt to really rectify that and to try and fill some of those gaps in our knowledge and to move forward in a way that deliberately acknowledges those past histories.
Yeah, I'm glad you chose this one as well. And of course, thankful to Melissa for approaching this as a highlightable collecting area, because, you know, the alternative press, you know, specifically is very much a collection that began as like a subscription, almost like an in the present moment, grabbing newspapers and then continuing to have those newspapers brought to the library and added to the collection. And, you know, we would basically be missing an entire decade or two had we not continued these kinds of subscriptions, which, you know, we can go into a little rabbit hole about, like, how money gets spent at libraries and the subscription concepts around, why collect in the now versus buy the very expensive historical. But, I'm also very glad that she pointed to how this is the continuation of doing our work, almost.
Right. Right.
So very useful. And one thing that I wanted to kind of tease out a little bit here. So Melissa is using very much now content in this video. What are the limitations of folks accessing, you know, something that is super copyrighted, just came out yesterday, and you cannot see a digital copy of it unless you pay for it? What do you have to say about that?
Right. So that's one of those challenges of not only archives and sort of how we collect and why we collect, but also the challenge of the current copyright environment, you know, that we live in. Art magazines and sort of working with creators and acquiring this material as it's being created, you know, does run up against our ability to what we would like to ideally do is to acquire something and then to make it as widely available as possible through any format, through digitization, through our reading room, through classes, through projects like this. And we can do that to an extent, but there are limitations around copyright and intellectual property that, you know, sort of stymie us from being as accessible as we'd like to be. So, you know, you can definitely always come in to the archives, request this material, look at it on site. But it's also, I think, a sort of call to action or an opportunity for us as we are working, especially with contemporary creators, you know, as we are purchasing or working with donors, you know, to acquire this material, to have that conversation at the point of acquisition. So at the point of either the donation or purchasing it from the artist, to talk about the purpose of archives, the exposure that this work gets when it's widely available, the potential for it to be, you know, impactful and distributed widely and sort of meaningful in lots of different ways, if we can come to some agreement around, you know, we won't distribute this in commercial venues, but maybe we can put it online in our digital repository. And so those are the kinds of conversations that we have with donors and with artists. And sometimes it's really successful and sometimes it's not, but it's definitely something that we continue to advocate for because we recognize the importance of, especially from an equity and sort of accessibility perspective, being able to provide access in as wide a sort of range of formats as possible is so critical to getting this material out there.
And those would-be researchers listening to us right now, you know, don't let any of the concepts around copyright be a roadblock to you thinking about coming in and seeing something, coming in and possibly using something for an educational purpose. You know, we have this general caveat that anything more or less for student work or sort of your own personal knowledge can be used and can be sort of worked within to a project. A lot of times this copyright issue is just about who gets paid. And if somebody's getting paid, that needs to be clarified before anything happens with it. So just that general caveat, you know, the archives works like a library.
Definitely.
Anyone's welcome. Please come in at any time. So in terms of the reception of this exhibition, have you heard anything? How have people been receiving this, those who have seen it?
Yeah, I think we've gotten some really positive feedback. You know, probably the first metric is looking at YouTube and looking at the, you know, who's watching it and how long they're watching it and whether they're commenting or that sort of thing. And we've seen some really, really great engagement, especially, I have to say, from our railroad community of enthusiasts and researchers. They are all over Laura's videos on the New Haven Comet, which is awesome. But we're also, you know, seeing people come to us from outside that community. We were recently reviewed in one of our regional archives, sort of professional archives groups publications. And some of the comments we've got, some of the comments that we've received from that have been really insightful. I think people are getting the point that we were trying to put across. They're really understanding sort of the thought and the intention that went behind a project like this. We also see that they're watching long portions of the video, and that's really key to sort of understanding if something is compelling enough for someone. But yeah, some of the things that we've heard, you know, folks are excited to sort of see professional archivists talk about their work and sort of exercise their expertise, both in subject matter knowledge, but also all of the sort of thoughtfulness and intentionality that goes behind the practice of collecting, that idea of collection stewardship and all of the activities that go into stewardship, I think really come across in these videos. And we've received a lot of feedback that's been really positive in that regard.
That's heartening to hear that folks like maybe enjoy seeing the back end work of what an archivist does, which is, you know, kind of this mystifying unknown, I guess, that only really gets brought out in films and it's like in the basement or someone who's hiding secrets or something. So that's good to know that people are actually interested in that. I know one thing that stuck out to me immediately was hopefully the charm of the amateurishness of how each of us went about doing what we were doing. But you know, I think that almost stands off as kind of our sheer desire to, you know, compel the the viewer to, you know, maybe take a little bit more interest in the things that we're doing. So the viewing time, that shows me that people actually are getting that, and I'm happy to hear about that.
Definitely.
Very cool. Okay, well, that's a great little sketch about this exhibition that we've had up now for just over a year, and it's, again, 25 for 25. You can check it out on the YouTube channel, as well as our website, located at the University of Connecticut Archives and Special Collections. We are in the Dodd Center for Human Rights. Any final ideas or anything you want to tell listeners, Rebecca, about accessing the archives or pursuing more of our programming like this?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to emphasize or sort of reemphasize your point that we are open to all. You are welcome to visit us at any point, to check out our digital resources. And if there's anything that discussed today, you know, that we talked about today that piqued your interest, there's a ton of information about how to visit us or how to access these collections on our website. Continue to check us out. And if you're interested in our digital collections, you can find those at the Connecticut Digital Archive.
And we want to thank, in addition, Emily Coe and Steve Bustamante, who really helped handhold us through this long process of kind of getting our feet for both the design, the communications, and, you know, making that amateurishness not look
too amateur.
Too amateur, exactly. Okay, well, thanks, Rebecca, for being on the show. Good to chat about this, and we'll see everybody next time.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. You can find out more about the UConn Archives and Special Collections at UConn Archives on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes or listen online at whus.org. Our theme song is Dream in Casio Tone by Arable Lands, graphic design by Melica Bloom. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.